How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. On February 16th, 2024, the Alabama Supreme Court brought fertility care in that state to a screeching halt and started a national conversation by declaring that frozen embryos were people in the eyes of the law. That's the first line of Laura Hersher's Scientific American article called How Arguments That Embryos Are People Pose a Threat to IVF. And we are lucky enough to have Laura, the author, joining us for this discussion, or I should say rejoining us, because you've been on a bunch of episodes of DNA Today. So thanks for coming on, Laura.
Nice to be here, Kira.
So for those that somehow don't know Laura Hersher, you are clearly not entrenched in genetics enough. No, I don't mean to be making fun of people. But yeah, she's been on a bunch of episodes of DNA Today. Laura, you've kind of become our correspondent on when legislation affects reproductive medicine and rights, and we'll get to an exciting announcement at the end of the show about exciting projects that you're working on in this space. But for those that don't know, Laura is a fellow genetic counselor and the director of student research at Sarah Lawrence College's genetic counseling program, where you were actually my thesis advisor when I was a student, graduated back in 2020. And her work as a commentator and journalist has been published in a wide variety of media outlets, including MIT Tech Review, The Nation Magazine, New York Times. I mean, you name it, you've kind of been published there. So, Laura, I want to provide people an overview of the Alabama Supreme Court case and its ruling regarding the legal status of frozen embryos, because maybe people saw headlines, but they don't really know exactly what's going on. So what's your kind of recap to fill people in?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that can get lost in all the crazy is that there's a real story and a real injury that started this case. And it's sort of a hard to fathom story. I just feel like there's probably more than anybody's saying. But according to the court records, somebody, according to the story, a patient in the hospital wandered through an unlocked door into a lab where an IVF center kept frozen embryos. It went into the freezer, which should not have been an easy thing to do, removed a number of frozen embryos, and very late in the day realized they were extremely cold and dropped them on the floor. So this is not a story that makes any kind of sense to anyone who's ever been around an IVF lab, or even someone like me who has not been around an IVF lab but pays enough attention. It doesn't make any sense. But this is, in fact, the story that the courts have told. That's been told in court, let's put it that way. And I don't want to lose track of the fact that there was a very real injury here. Three different couples lost embryos. Nobody gets to IVF without it being an incredible, heartbreaking process. It's expensive. It's painful. It's emotional. And it's a real loss to have embryos destroyed. But it's a loss that the courts across the country have had a hard time figuring out how to describe. What is it exactly? It's not exactly like somebody's stolen something from you, taken something from you. What they've taken is potential. Anyway, there's a lot of different ways to envision this, but the way that the Alabama Supreme Court envisioned it, what they decided was that these were people. And this is a civil case, so it's not a murder trial, though in theory, and this is not unimportant, it could be. But what they said was that they could sue for wrongful death. And in fact, that the only thing they could sue for was wrongful death. They didn't have to look at any of the other charges because that was the main issue here. This idea, which is generally given the name of personhood, that from some fixed point, and generally that point is conception, on a blastocyst, an embryo, a fetus, is a person with all the rights there too, is it started out as a fringy idea in the anti-abortion movement that has gone really mainstream. Like, and it's embedded now in our laws. It's embedded in multiple state laws, state constitutions, and so on. So, but it's a very, very extreme proposition. The idea that when you start to think about it, it's very extreme. And when it plays out, as in this circumstance, the extremeness of it shows up. So immediately thereafter, they made that announcement like, okay, most of the IVF facilities in the state of Alabama said, well, we cannot do what we do in the clinic. We cannot create embryos, freeze embryos, test embryos, choose embryos. We can't do any of it if embryos are people and all of the liability that would reside in that becomes a part of the process.
With this being so threatening to IVF centers and just with all of this potential liability, I imagine a lot of IVF centers have just been like, this is too much to deal with. We're just not going to continue care in Alabama or places that we're going to start an IVF center. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. Well, the initial reaction in Alabama was that most IVF centers just ceased business for a period of time. There was a law passed in the legislature, in a sort of an emergency way, because this is, on a nonpartisan basis, IVF is super popular. 85% of Republicans also are, you know, pro-IVF strongly.
That's an important point in terms of Republicans' views in something that affects reproductive medicine. That's major.
Yes, right. So they, and laws are written so cured. Laws are written so they don't make any sense at all. They say things like an unborn person is a person from the moment of conception in the uterus, which is just an attempt to sort of step around IVF.
It's
like, well, it has to be. And I'm like, but I'm like, well, if you believe that conception is magic, I mean, well, do you believe that it's uterine magic? Like somehow it's not something that when you take a hard look at it, it makes a lot of sense. And that's one of the issues with the fact that this language is embedded in our laws on a federal level and a state level. And that people have worked now for decades to embed that language in the law for just this reason.
To basically have IVF be an exception to a lot of these laws.
Well, they've tried to make IVF an exception, but the overarching goal of the people who are interested in the personhood movement is to make all abortion illegal.
It's tough when we hear, oh, it's all simple and everything in terms of an abortion is considered murder, because you start getting into different scenarios. Most people, and we're both American-based, most people would say, okay, in different situations, it is not simple. If someone was raped, if someone was pregnant and it was causing life-threatening situation to them. So, I mean, just from there, it's like, I'm surprised that with the anti-abortion movement that they're able to even get this far in terms of an embryo is a person.
Yeah, it does seem sort of amazing. I mean, personally, obviously, I'm someone who believes that you don't need some outrageous, like, I'm going to die if I don't have this abortion to just, like, you don't owe someone else a justification of
Yep, we're on the same page there. Shocker, yeah. Right? We're genetic counselors.
Yeah. But I also say all the time, I was like, I believe that. I think it's really important, the message. And I'm like, and also, let's talk about that 10-year-old rape victim every day from now till the election. Because it brings home for people in the starkest way possible that this isn't simple, and it's not, you can't make a rule and have it fit for all circumstances. And that's sort of where this whole IVF piece comes in, right? Because if you say, in the interest of outlawing all abortions, that all embryos are people, and that's it. That's a simple thing. Like, you can't possibly have abortion. You find yourself saying outlandish things like, You never need to end somebody's pregnancy to save their life, which anyone in the clinical space knows that's just not true.
No, ectopic pregnancies. Like there's one where that pregnancy is not viable and it's stuck in the fallopian tube or somewhere else where that will cause severe pain and possibly death. You would probably know that better than me.
There are multiple
so many
conditions where the medical advice you're going to get is to end a pregnancy. Because of the condition in the fetus, because of the condition in the pregnant person. The point is that they end up denying reality because the notion that they're starting with is so extreme that it actually implies all of these outcomes. Same thing with IVF. So most people want IVF. They want IVF to be okay. Most of the Republican congressmen in Congress, people in Washington, have signed an amendment that has never passed saying that, guess what? People are people, fully people from the moment of conception. And then they're like, but not IVF. Well, and on a politician level, they try to say like, well, these things are perfectly amenable. You can make them work. But no, you absolutely cannot make them work. You cannot manipulate embryos, freeze embryos, test embryos, select embryos if they're fully people with rights under the law. And they're not the only ones with liability. You can try to limit their liability, but other people have liability. It doesn't work. The example they chose in one of the concurrences to this thing, they said like, well, look, they make this work in Italy. That was a straight up error. They passed a bunch of laws in Italy to this effect, saying you could only create 3 embryos and they all had to be transferred because you couldn't freeze embryos, you couldn't create excess embryos. And those laws were repealed in 2008 because in fact they didn't work. They were a disaster. People were just leaving the country to get IVF because you can't. You it doesn't work. You create, so all of these things, assuming that they don't, and this is nothing to take for granted, to be honest with you, but assuming that the laws are done state by state and you have restrictions in some states and not in others. And I don't expect, because they're so unpopular, I'm not predicting that they'll create sort of things saying like IVF is not allowed, but they'll create laws like we have right now in Louisiana saying you cannot freeze embryos. So Louisiana takes advantage of the fact that you can simply transport your embryos somewhere else. And that's what they do. But if you have a bunch of contiguous states where you can't do that, first of all, if they're limiting the number of embryos that can be created at any one time, all of this serves to make IVF more expensive and less attainable.
That's what I was thinking, because it's just so hard, because if someone goes and they're like, okay, I'm going for an egg retrieval, they might be like, well, you only got so many eggs. We recommend another round, and then create like, you know, freezing eggs versus freezing embryos. Okay, say only so many of those eggs even made it to the embryo stage. Only so many of those embryos are growing. It's already so hard and relatively expensive. I cannot imagine making this more expensive.
It's incredibly expensive. And everything you do to add expense doesn't get rid of IVF. It restricts who has access. In this country already, more than half of the people who would want access to IVF don't have it. It's already not only a scarce and expensive resource, to which we do not offer equitable access.
No.
And this will just make it more so in those areas. There's already what they call IVF deserts. There's much more IVF facilities available on the coasts than there is in rural and southern areas, western areas. Everything we add to this just makes it worse. So the kerfluffle in Alabama was both maddening, funny, absurd,
tragic. It's all of these things at once.
But what's actually going to happen subtly and pervasively is that IVF will be just that much harder to obtain for the average person. Still there for somebody with wealth and means and resources and education and all those things that allow you to sort of access what you want to access, even if it's not available the next town over. So that's really tragic. And to those people is really tragic. What this decision was ludicrous and nuts, but actually in keeping with what is in the law in many, many states. By the way, some of those laws were written not with abortion in mind. Some of those laws were written to protect, for instance, victims of spousal abuse, so that if somebody was harmed during a pregnancy, which is unfortunately a time where there's a lot of spousal abuse, and in that harm, the fetus was injured or lost, that there was a way to go after that person under the law.
Interesting.
Which is fine, which is understandable that you would want that option, but you can create a law that sort of specifies fetal loss, fetal damage, so on. But a lot of those laws were written to sort of say the fetus is, for these criminal purposes, a person, and then therefore this is murder, this is manslaughter, this is abuse, and so on. And already we've already seen that many of those same laws are being misused to go after pregnant individuals who have miscarriages or who have drug problems and so on, and recharacterize those as child abuse with criminal penalties. And like, look at the reality that essentially only happens to the most vulnerable individuals in vulnerable places. So it's already, there's really a checkered history around this whole idea of personhood and how it will be applied. And this is just one more thing. And in a sense, you look at the Alabama thing, and a part of the story is that the Alabama Supreme Court said, as I said in the piece, said the quiet part out loud, which is like, oh, we've done this reading of what's in the Constitution, and it actually means you can't treat embryos as anything but people. I said to somebody recently, I was like, well, okay, but if parents abandon them, which they probably will, because it's very expensive to keep paying for storage for forever, does the state have to keep paying for the storage? Because like, those are abandoned children, like are they going to put them in embryo workhouses?
Yeah, how does that work? Because theoretically, embryos could just be frozen indefinitely.
None of it actually makes any sense. And it's distracting in a way. But also the other part of it is, gosh, they fixed this fast for the wealthy families who can afford IVF. And I know that, and thank goodness also for all the not wealthy families who've mortgaged their homes, right, to have those embryos there and try to use them. So like, sympathy to them. But basically, it touched on the people who are part of the power structure in the world and who want this amenity of their lives, as I would. And they fixed it in 2 weeks flat, right? But it's still lurking there. The diehard anti-abortion forces like the Susan B. Anthony
Foundation, I think.
Yeah. They objected very much to this fixed law. They objected to Trump saying yesterday that it should go to the states and there shouldn't be a national ban. Like, there's a good solid percentage of the country that's just like, we were promised that embryos are people, and that's really the only reality that we're going to set, and everything that comes with it. And it's, I want people to understand how extreme a position that is, and it's really the mainstream Republican position at the moment.
One question you bring up in the article, and I'm going to paraphrase it, will the popularity of IVF alone suffice to safeguard the right to fertility care? Obviously, IVF is so popular. And I don't mean to say popular in the sense of, oh, it's a fad, but like, it is a medical reproductive technology that we need for some people to be able to be pregnant and to have biological children, which people should be able to do if they want to. But also in our world, as we were saying, to prevent certain conditions from being passed on, because in order to genetically test an embryo, you need to do IVF to have that option. And oftentimes we are freezing embryos as part of that process.
Let's be clear, Kira. You cannot do any of that testing without freezing embryos.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying that.
None of that is possible.
You can't test and do a fresh transfer.
Right. It's impossible. Yeah. It's not feasible. And people that suggest that all of these have fixes are just snowball. They're just gaslighting you, right? They're like telling you, no, there's an easy fix for all this. There are no fixes for this. If you want the modern fertility medicine that's offered through IVF, then you cannot also claim that embryos be treated exactly like people. I mean, honestly, the idea of treating all embryos like people doesn't make any sense anyway. I mean, so the things that, you know, I mean, they talk to this audience, they know that. It's like, you're not unique people. You could clone them, you could recreate them, you can identical twin them, but also most of them don't survive, you know?
Yeah.
They're a precarious state. So it's not a good functional definition. So what you're asking, what happens? What happens here? Well, a couple of things to be aware of. One is, one of the more hidden costs of the 4 years of the Trump presidency is that Trump did a really efficient job of stacking the judiciary after years of strife in Congress that made it difficult to confirm judges. So there were lots and lots of spaces, and the judiciary is stacked with very young, very extreme people because they were came all out of the Federalist Society, sort of this one organization sort of said, here's your judges. And a lot of them are very extreme. I mean, look at the decisions we've had. Look at Michael Kazmierczak in the Fifth District Court deciding that mifepristone, he is a better authority than the FDA, and he thinks mifepristone is not safe enough for use. I mean, I think that's
which is a drug to take to induce an abortion, medication.
Is some rando justice in Texas said, like, oh, the FDA convened an expert panel, looked at this, studied it for 20 years, looked at it again, looked at performance data after years, and made a series of decisions. But I, Michael Kazmierczak, am pretty sure I know better. Based on what my clerk got from Google last night, I think it's too dangerous. And so these judges didn't like crawl out of the woodwork. They were put in place, and our country is stacked with them. And it's kind of like time bombs as far as stuff like this go. Like, so if you're a IVF provider and you're one of the relatively small number of REIs coming out of the training every year, it's like, where would you want to practice? Right? Would you want to practice somewhere where one day a legal decision can come down and suddenly, you know, not only is what you're doing illegal, but also like you could be sued for anything. You could be stripped of your license for things that are legal.
Not just your business goes under, but like you go under. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just so much uncertainty. One can only assume that you would have a drift away from services in these areas. And unfortunately, it's always the same people who are shortchanged.
It is.
So this is, you know, just another piece of that big picture, but a very frustrating one. And yeah, I mean, I think one of the things to look for is people trying to sell the public on the idea that there is a way to do IVF and to have your cake and eat it too on this, that there is a way, and there isn't.
Comes to being able to, I mean, so many things, but being able to test embryos, as we talked about, for genetic conditions, and to be able to have someone go through multiple rounds and create embryos. What are you going to create embryos, do a fresh transfer every time? Like the timeline just doesn't make sense. And those are the two main things that I see as just not working at all. And I would think because it's so absurd.
An embryo each time, right?
Like right.
The chances of that embryo. So the you'd go back to doing transferring two or three at a time, having all the issues with multiples, all of those issues.
The list is kind of endless.
It is. And even then, even when you did all that, you would still have issues of who could sue who, right?
Yeah.
How do you resolve custody disputes over embryos if you're viewing them as people? What about grandparents? How do you, you know, one of the things was not only did all the IVF clinics shut down, the company that transports embryos, there's sort of one company that does a lot of embryo transports, said, well, I'm not working in Alabama. We don't want the liability.
People that literally like take the embryos and bring them to a new place, shipping.
These poor people, they get a phone call saying, we have, you know, 10 of your embryos frozen that were your blood, sweat, and tears and a lot of money, and we can't use them. And then they call up and they say, well, okay, we want to transfer them to another state so I can go to a facility there and use them.
Yeah.
Like, transport companies won't pick up those embryos in Alabama and bring them somewhere else. This was like,
oh
the
my God,
in the wake of that. Why would they want to subject their drivers to like the issues of like, what if something got thawed? Like, there's just too much liability associated with this, and too many unknowns. And the Attorney General of Alabama was saying, oh, I'm not going to prosecute anyone for anything criminal for embryos. Like, I promise that. Like, well, no, don't worry. Because the people were trying to simmer things down.
What about civil?
But the Attorney General of Alabama is the same guy who a few weeks earlier was saying that he was going to prosecute anybody that helped anybody travel out of Alabama for an abortion. So am I feeling confident in his...
My trust level's pretty low there. Yeah, that's... Do you see a possibility where other places in the country, maybe even all the states, follow suit, or there's a national ban basically on freezing embryos? Do you see that as a possibility, or is it just too far-fetched because of what we've been talking about? Like, how worried should we be about being able to use IVF in the future in the United States?
No, I mean, realistically, I don't see there being a will to create a national ban for freezing embryos. I do see that individual states could very well try to create limits on, you know, I mean, in the same way that they presented limits on abortion before Dobbs presented limits on abortion as being civil rights law or protecting women's health or something, like, they could create, as Louisiana has, limits on things like the number of embryos that can be created at any one time, how they're treated, whether or not they can be frozen, things like that, that all serve to make IVF more difficult to assess and more expensive. But realistically, I mean, I think it's hard for me to imagine that something this politically unpopular gets far, but you know, in the same way, it's like, look, I'm pretty sure last year, all three of my daughter and my two daughters-in-law, they're all pregnant last year. It was a crazy year in the Hersher household.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, very, very fun. And I never for a moment wondered if anything went wrong with their pregnancy, that they would be arrested. And someone would accuse them because they didn't look upset enough, or some other subjective measure of maybe they had taken steps to end, or maybe they had put their pregnancy in danger. Maybe they had, this is something that actually happened. Maybe they went to a bar and got in a fight and they got stabbed in the stomach, but they had provoked that, and they should have been more careful because they knew they were pregnant and they were safeguarding that child. I mean, no way in my wildest dreams did any of these things, I would think they were going to happen to my three kids, because they weren't, okay? And that's one of the sort of secret ills in this, is that we tend to talk about this as like, will IVF be shut off or not shut off? But the truth is, as with most of these things, what really happens is, who's losing access is the real question, not will they make something, you know, popular? I mean, I do worry about, I don't go into the weeds, I do worry about the ways in which they could make abortion difficult all over the country. But at the end of the day, the empowered individual is going to get what they want here, but they have a great deal of latitude to make it more difficult for the rest of us. And for the more vulnerable populations. And frankly, that's really frustrating to me. And to feed into what you said with this project, I mean, I think there's a big picture here where this is just one little piece of, which is to say that here we are expanding all the things we can do in the prenatal arena, right? I mean, you're in that field, not me, right?
Oh, it's amazing to see what we can do now of like looking at sequencing genomes, exomes of a fetus. It's amazing.
Right, right. And people who are coming into the pregnancies, they already have, if they have a family history of cancer or heart disease, they've already done panel testing. They know if they have a single gene that's creating susceptibility. They've done carrier screening. They know if they're carriers. There's all of this stuff that is out there, and we might talk about it as we, but collectively, that's really on offer to only a certain percentage of the population. And then so is the way to act on it. So is IVF. So is abortion. So is even prenatal testing. All of these things, there are huge and subtle obstacles to access. And I think as a genetic counselor, one of the things that really concerns me and what Kira mentioned in the beginning, what I'm writing about now, is that I feel that we are not paying enough attention to the fact that we are rapidly heading toward a place where there are whole categories of genetic conditions that are only going to happen to these vulnerable populations.
Yes.
And look, it's great. It's so exciting that we have these new gene therapies that cost $2 and $3 million a patient, and that we have, you know, in utero therapies, like it's really exciting. But we don't have the will to spend that money now. Like, are we going to be able to muster the societal interest in helping individuals when it's only certain people and we kind of know who those certain people are? That's just something that very much worries me.
The implication of the haves and have nots, of it's going to create this divide where people that can afford to have a lot of preventative medicine, all right, then we're not going to have those genetic conditions pop up in wealthier groups of people. And then there's not going to be as many resources for people that do have those conditions because it only affects poorer and lower socioeconomic areas. I think one thing that I learned when I was your student was we can look at like other countries, and you'll have to, you know, help me remember, but I think Iceland, like there's very few people with Down syndrome. So there's like no resources or very limited resources. So I think that's a good analogy and kind of a scary future in terms of what everything can happen. And we're kind of teasing it, but you have this exciting project you're working on, you're writing a new book, and it dives into all of this, the societal implications of reproductive genomic medicine, specifically in the United States. And you have been able to really follow throughout your career all this legislation, how it impacts people. And I can't wait to read the book. Do you have an idea when it will be released, or is it still very much you're in writing mode?
This is the worst possible question.
I know. I was going to end with the worst question. Can I get a copy? Question. When will I get a copy?
Well, you're younger than me, so in your lifetime, I hope that you can get a copy. I wouldn't say it's going quickly. And it's partly, I mean, I signed the contract to write this book, I think literally 3 weeks before Dobbs happened.
Oh God. So your whole outline changed.
No, everything. I mean, both, I felt like more pressure, like this makes it more relevant.
Yes.
But at the same time, I spent about a year writing about the impact of Dobbs on the genetic counseling community.
Yep.
Going to conferences and learning from people about the laws.
You did interviews on the Beagles Landed podcast, your show.
I've spent a lot of that year really digging into what is the implications of not having Roe v. Wade anymore.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, it made me feel much more, even more lit up about doing the project.
Sure.
Which I call the ghettoization of genetic disease. But at the same time, put me about a year behind. So I mean, don't talk to writers. We just whine about these things all the time. But yeah. So someday, but meanwhile, I just think it's important that people think about it, that there's really sort of broad societal level implications that kind of go under the radar. Because I very much fear that if we're not intentional about our commitment to people with genetic conditions and genetic diseases, it would be easy to start seeing them as the product of bad planning instead of bad luck, and treat people, you know, in a way that's in accordance with that. And it's wrong. It's highly eugenic.
It is.
And people should not have to do genetic testing to be treated like full human beings with all the rights and privileges. And I mean, like, once you're born, only once you're born. But also, people should be given the same opportunities as other people in this country to, you know, to have access to whatever the technology they need, depending on their own views and situation and desires.
Completely, completely agree. I know you'll never watch the movie because it's one of your sticks now, but I can't help but think about Gattaca as we're talking about this. And
all
I know
right, I'm breaking news, Kira. I watched Gattaca.
Are you serious?
I know.
That is a major announcement in genetics. Laura Hersher watched Gattaca.
Kind of made me. There was a 25th anniversary of Gattaca, and I did a podcast for Genomics England, and they were like, you got to watch the movie. And I said, no, I don't watch it.
No, yeah, no, but that's always been your thing. I've known you for years. You've always said, I haven't watched it. I won't watch it. Wow.
Well, then they said, we'll pay for it. And I'm like, it's $5. It's not a money issue.
Yeah. That's so funny.
I can't afford to watch. But I didn't actually make it all the way through. But I did. I have to say, I give them some credit for being kind of interestingly accurate. I had an argument on Blue Skies with somebody who was like, that's about genetic engineering. And I'm like, strangely enough, it is not about genetic engineering.
No,
it's about embryo selection.
About choosing the best embryo. They're not editing the embryos. So I think that's very interesting. But I mean, isn't
this mansplaining guy? He was like, "How did you think they got all those embryos?" And I said, "I think it's something called in vitro gametogenesis. But let's not discuss that now." But anyway, he was like, "Wow, you're just wrong. We obviously it's genetic engineering."
Rewatch that scene where the geneticist, genetic counselor person is sitting down with the couple. That's not what's happening, but it is interesting because that movie came out in 1997 and I watch it every couple years, and it's amazing how much in the movie over the years more and more of it is actually things that we have that technology now. So it's I'm amazed that, you know, obviously
another
I've learned
episode,
so much
Kira.
But
another episode.
Well, there's always one that's pending with us, which is awesome, right? We always have something going on behind the scenes. But Laura, thank you so much for coming on. Laura Hersher, everybody, you are like the person to interview about legislation and how that affects reproductive medicine, especially in the genetic space. You know, as soon as your book comes out, we're going to have you back on. You know, hopefully I can get a copy of it, maybe even signed. That would be awesome. I'll come by Sarah Lawrence.
Anything.
We'll have a chat. But you're such a pleasure to interview. And I think there's just so much info there. We'll drop the other episodes that you've been on DNA Today in the show notes so people can check out those episodes too, because we did a really good one about when Dobbs was overturned. Thank you so much. This is really enlightening. For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.